This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Like many people classified as blind, I can actually see quite a lot. Although, again, like most blind people, my blindness is unique. To paraphrase Tolstoy, all perfect sight is alike. All imperfect sight is imperfect in its own way. In my case, one eye has a large dark cloud across it. The other is riven with faults like crackle-finished glass. Yet the memories of life with functioning eyes are still strong, more than a year after they failed. And so I can compare the much-changed world in which I am now immersed with its predecessor. Those changes are illuminating. When something breaks, it reveals its true nature. In our electronic age, we talk of eyes as cameras, of the brain as an image-recognising computer, of our limited ability to absorb information as running out of bandwidth. In the past, the metaphors also reflected the spirit of their age. The Victorians saw the brain as a telephone switchboard, and in a pre-industrial age, theories of sight revolved around God, as ubiquitous and unquestioned a power in the world then as electricity is in ours. Many medieval theologians considered light to have divine properties, because God and light alone can penetrate objects without destroying them. The 11th century Islamic theologian Al-Ghazali, who moved much Muslim thought from science into religion, often described God as light, not only because light was the most visible of things, but because it caused all things to become visible. But as with so much in our materialistic age, physics and biology have supplanted the divine. We now know what many philosophers, ancient and modern, have long suspected. What we perceive as the illuminated world of things around us is nothing of the sort. It is built instant by instant by the mechanisms of mind and body. To understand this, we have to focus on the very root of how we see. The creation of our world begins not in the Garden of Eden, but in the retina, where focused light from the outside world is broken down into its constituent colours, split up into millions of points, and the contrast between light and dark enhanced. Some of the sensor cells actively suppress dim parts of the image, and all of the infrared and ultraviolet light that many other creatures see is thrown away. That's all before the brain becomes involved. Already, the image of the world is modified. The optic nerve, actually a millimetre-thick bundle of around a million nerve fibres, picks up the signals from the retina and passes them to the brain. It's got about the same capacity to carry data as a broadband internet connection, but annoyingly for me, can't be replaced by a short length of cable. When the image reaches the brain and hits the visual cortex, things really get going. It's broken down by an intricate network of neurons which pick out the edges, lines, areas of colour, areas in motion, textures, and more complex components of the image. This creates a melange of signals, which other, deeper levels of analysis then build back into an impression, not of an undifferentiated scene, but of recognisable objects. I spent a lot of my early life driven by the urge to understand technology. Things that looked simple, but once opened up and taken apart, became a mess of incomprehensible objects. Few radios in the family home survived. As I became a self-taught engineer, and later got my first job as a programmer, I discovered that all technology becomes mysterious at some depth. It's just a question of where you stop asking and start working with what you've got. With eyesight, you don't get very far. The structures which tear down the picture on the retina and create the image in the mind are as impenetrable to the layman as medieval theology, and as full of mysterious concepts. Even the cells come in the bewildering bestiary, spiny pyramidal and stellate, basket, jewel bouquet, chandelier. There are over 40 different kinds that just connect other cells together, and they are wired in an even more mesmerising mesh of layers, columns, bundles and lumps. The results can be bizarrely precise. In one set of experiments, patients with brain electrodes implanted for other reasons were found to have single nerve cells that fired only when they saw pictures of Bill Clinton, others with the Beatles, or the cartoon Simpsons family. Which means that one of our 86 billion brain cells is entirely devoted to, say, Boris Johnson's face, and another to that of our mother. Although visual science is an extraordinarily active area of research, many of the phenomena, including that one, remain utterly mysterious. It is very far from clear how cognition and vision are linked, how what we see influences our consciousness. But that they are deeply interwoven is undeniable, both from our experiences in everyday life and from the investigations of the scientists. But we are still at the very early stage of describing, let alone understanding, how things are wired together. Some 800 different major sets of connections have been identified between the visual and the higher thought centres, suggesting that what neuroscientists call early vision, the processing that occurs before we become consciously aware of what we see, extracts nearly 1,000 separate aspects of the image in our eyeball. We then have to re-knit those aspects virtually instantaneously into the pictures in our head. Further evidence from the study of brain disorders hints at how we do this. There are conditions that attack extremely specific visual capabilities. One is akinetopsia, a very rare disease that prevents sufferers from seeing motion. Instead, they perceive the world as a series of still images. Pouring coffee becomes difficult as the stream of liquid looks frozen, like a glacier. As people move around a room, they appear as statues that simply vanish in one place and appear in another. Such cases are linked to damage to small parts of the visual cortex. It is even possible to induce the condition, thankfully temporarily, in healthy people by magnetically stimulating those regions. On closer inspection through MRI scans, though, there appear to be 21 closely related but distinct areas involved in seeing motion. We have so much to learn. One of the fascinations of having my own optic nerves radically degrade has been the chance to observe some of the processing in the raw, at first hand. It's often possible to fool the mechanisms of sight with optical illusions that feed misleading signals into the mind that produce an incorrect result. But when sight breaks down, when expected signals are missing, the visual cortex supplies what it thinks should be there by a combination of innate and learned guesswork. The results are intriguing. Much of vision is really suppression, a signal from the eye that the visual cortex uses to close down possible interpretations. The circuitry that spots a vertical line, for example, does not differentiate between a small line and one that extends across the whole field of view. It fires off the same signal regardless. Other circuits, detecting what's beyond the end of the line, generate a second signal that overrides the line detector further down the pipeline of perception. When those modifying signals are not there, in my case because the bits of the optic nerve that relay them have died off, the brain synthesis goes wonky. It creates colours, patterns, motion. I have seen, and still see, seas of unreadable words, impossible reflections of primeval plants, lysergic versions of my grandmother's flock wallpaper. The visual system is breaking down my eyesight into a set of jigsaw pieces that my consciousness is reassembling, but the missing pieces aren't blank. Presented with signals that do not correspond to the image on my retinas, the visual cortex still assumes that they do, and presents me with faces in the fire. The whole is a gratifying demonstration of one of the major philosophical concepts of modern thought, phenomenology, the notion that nothing is actually knowable, as all our information comes through fallible channels. This wasn't new to me. I had discovered the idea in my early teens, while having the battle with faith and disbelief familiar to so many of us as our horizons widened towards adulthood. Again, realisation came through flaws in my eyes. I was looking at a copper beech tree in the garden on a summer's day, enjoying small jumps in perspective by alternately closing one eye, then the other. But then I noticed something unexpected. One eye, I discovered, saw colour in slightly different hues to the other. Which was right. Not only could I not tell, I couldn't tell whether there's any right answer there at all. I knew that the light itself was the same, and that what people in general agreed as red was a well-defined set of wavelengths thoroughly fixed in physics. In that sense, seeing a colour is like tuning in a radio station. But I was receiving two different programmes at the same time on the same channel. At first, I thought that one must be the wrong red and the other the right. On further consideration, that didn't cut the mustard. No version was better than the other, and there was no way of comparing which of the two matched what anyone else saw. Nor could people with perfectly matched eyes know that what they saw was the same as anyone else on the planet. It isn't possible, after all, to say that all perfect vision is perfect in the same way. The realisation that error was not only possible, it was undeniably present and could not be removed, but the certainties of creed and confession, until then as unquestioned a part of my world as the tree in the garden, into a new light. While Christianity certainly said that to be human was to be inescapably fallible, it also said that a proper knowledge of God was an infallible path to salvation. Frustratingly, the Christians I knew seemed unable to agree on exactly what that infallible path was, absent God bypassing senses altogether and informing them directly in a flash of revelation. But even those revelations always came packaged in light. The Book of Revelation itself is a feast of visions and visual metaphor, which to a teenager whose eyes were lying seemed equally poor as a conduit of cosmic certainty. This was my first introduction to how mechanisms of consciousness and perception define what we are, a realisation that I was only mildly annoyed to find had previously occurred to Immanuel Kant. He made the division between things as they actually exist, the noumena, and the representations of them we perceive, the phenomena, and said that the connections between the two, even if they closely correspond, cannot be truly known. It is intriguing to follow the development of these concepts into the ideas of Edmund Husserl, a German philosopher from the turn of the 20th century, who saw in them an answer to the attempts to accurately describe things by breaking them down to their components. If we are truly creatures of perception, he reasoned, then we must look inwards to find truth. Our universe lies there, which leads into existentialism and the notion that experience is all. The curious business of synthesising objectivity and communicating experience with others only makes sense from the inside out. That may be a compelling argument, but it also seems to doom us to a solipsistic life of uncertainty trapped in the darkness of our skulls. At this point, one looks back to the Enlightenment and the science it engendered, and light reappears. Reductionism, empiricism, categorisation of facts and logic, the very things that modern thinkers distrust as ways to understand awareness and thought, explain how we come to be so isolated, and what the bedrock of that isolation is. The two ways of understanding the world and ourselves, the outside-in of seeing, tasting, feeling, and the inside-out of examining our thoughts as the only things truly available for testing, may be islands, but they rest on the same continental shelf. For while we may not know how our thoughts truly match the world outside, we do know that our minds and thoughts have been created by that world. As very young children, it's the images that pour in that our visual system uses to program itself, to wire itself up. Light and dark, stasis and motion, texture and shape, all may be fiction, but they are fiction written by reality. It is enormously satisfying to find warring philosophies at heart are telling the same story. Contemplating the direct evidence of my broken eyes, perhaps the greatest satisfaction is a realisation that the universe I hold so fascinating, so dear to me, is purely inside me. Out there is truly unknowable. Not only is there no life after death, there is no anything. For me, at the moment of my cessation, the universe will vanish as surely as if it was instantly gobbled into a singularity. It simply makes no sense to think of its continuity beyond my existence. This isn't nihilism, but its opposite. It makes the fact of awareness truly awesome. There is no contradiction between a rational, sceptical, scientific mind and one awash in the transcendent. 30 years after I dismissed it, the true value of religion is becoming apparent for me, not in the revelation of truth, or its curiously human gods, but in the approaching of mystery, of the unknowable. It is at heart a sibling expression of the human spirit to that which drives the visual and cognitive scientists as they seek to unravel not just the animal fact of seeing, but the ineffable nature of consciousness, of ourselves.